Okay.
So, you know, we're in an interesting time in terms of health, in terms of environmental health, and the interface between science and policy. There are so many challenges, and the challenges are broadening, and we've met a lot of them. But as we get into things like cumulative risk assessment, sustainability, some of these issues, systems approaches, some of these issues have much greater breadth than we're accustomed to in, you know, the old-fashioned way of here's a chemical, what are the adverse effects of this chemical, let's go do something and find out about that. Clearly that's not enough. We need to go beyond that. We have started to go beyond it, but what are the issues that we're facing? So here's an outline. It's basically, I'm going to start off by talking about the research agenda, which was the original entire talk, and I just wanted to make sure that I kept in something which I think is a potential problem for those of us in public health, the over-reliance on logic models. I'm going to talk about some of the issues having to do with risk assessment and the precautionary principle. Risk assessment is if we start thinking of good public health theory, which we don't very often do in environmental health, risk assessment is really secondary prevention. There's something dirty out there, we're going to go clean it up. Precautionary principle should be applied mostly as primary prevention. We shouldn't get it out there in the first place. I can do a risk assessment for the benzene levels in this room and our risk of leukemia. The question is, how do we avoid having something like benzene get into our society? I'm going to talk about the systems approach, which is very nice. Everybody talks about the systems approach. The question is, why aren't we doing it? I'm going to talk about the anti-scientific attitudes that we've got in our society. And I know Mary Woolley is quite expert in dealing with that. But I'm going to basically say it's not just them, it's us. And I'm going to try to end on a positive note and talk about how the Chief Justice of Pennsylvania deserves a public health award. And for those younger folks who might not have heard of Gaylord Nelson, he's the founder of Earth Day way back when. Okay. In terms of research priority setting, we've always had this issue of who sets the research agenda. Do we as scientists set it? Do the policymakers set it? And I think my bias has always been that it's set really by the policymakers when we deal with classic environmental health issues that having to do with brownfields, having to do with global climate change. We want policy to be done. We don't want just to be research. And to have that communication go, we must have some degree of success. Well, the policymakers, particularly those in public health, we've been using more and more, we've been going to logic models. And they're very valuable logic models, and I'm a strong supporter of logic models. But one of the problems is it tends to move us toward applied research. It tends to lose the ability that we ought to have of providing a broader context, of providing the advances that on which the better policy can be based, on which the science that's more applicable to the logic models can be based. Logic models, and I know NIEHS has struggled and gotten some ones that read very well, but frankly, when you're doing basic research, you're putting science into a big, big pool. You're not going right to somebody's impact, and somebody else is pulling out of that pool and making the impact. And we need people to be able to focus on adding things to the pool that might be useful. We need this sort of interface between, if you will, applied and basic research, which is really a continuum. We need to be able to work with the policymaker to make sure that a lower-ranking priority that cuts across many different areas gets funded. So the air office at EPA might have, you know, we need to do a better job on developmental anomalies related to air pollutants, and so might the water office and the pesticides and everybody else, but it's all below their specific needs that they're asking for. Somehow or other, the researcher has to, the scientists at EPA have to be able to work on that because it is pertinent to all. How do we get these cross-cutting things done? And we need to be able to say as scientists to the head of EPA or the head of FDA or any of these other agencies that, you know, your number one priority is something which we probably can't do much about because we just don't have the science we need to be able to move forward on. But your number two priority, we can do something. And so the ability to switch priorities based upon our research skills and the research approaches. The public health principles, I mentioned that that we've got risk assessment is something that we use really for secondary prevention. My feeling has been that we spend too much time as risk assessors focusing on decimal points that are not part of the data quality objective needed by the person who's going to make a decision. It's very hard to find any risk manager who ever wants a range for a number. They want one number. They're not going to use a range. And that's true not just in environmental health. It's true throughout. I went through the Affordable Care Act's, the Congressional Budget Office data on the Affordable Care Act that they gave to Congress, and there are, I don't know, probably thousands of different estimates that they make of dollar costs. Now, these are economists. They're good with arithmetic. They're good with math. They could do uncertainty analysis. They never do it. Now, if you can make a decision about the Affordable Care Act without having all sorts of uncertainty analysis, at what place is it that we feel that we need to get a couple of extra decimal places for the risk of many compounds? Not necessary, something we just have to stop pushing ahead. On precautionary principle, there's sort of a tautology, a logical thing that's in there that says, if you're going to invoke the precautionary principle, you have to tell us what research you're going to do. Let me explain that. I mean, here are three ways of looking at what's needed, the three conditions to be met. You need some scientific information suggesting there's a risk. You need uncertainty as to the extent. If you were certain, you'd obviously would need to invoke the precautionary principle. And there must be some significant economic or social cost. Because if there wasn't, it would cost $1.25 to deal with this thing that you were sort of worried about but didn't have scientific proof, you'd do it. What does that mean? Very simply, it means that the extent to which a society lives by the precautionary principle can best be measured by the extent to which precautionary actions turn out to have been unnecessary or erroneous or even counterproductive. And the stronger the definition of the precautionary principle and its wide definitions, the more likely you are to have been wrong. That's as simple as that. So how can you basically have some sort of major, costly, societal impact be advocated without trying to find out if you're right or wrong? Let's do it. We've got good precautionary reasons to do it, but let's find out if we're right or wrong, because if we're wrong about it, we ought to know as quickly as we can, because there's something else that's killing the bees or doing these other things that we're worried about. The systems approach. Over and over again, we talk about systems approach, we talk about sustainability, we talk about working together across boundaries, and we just don't do it as well as we should. I'm going to argue that exposure assessment is crucial to this, and we need to focus on that. We need to basically go beyond hazard identification to really risk if we're going to be able to do these things systematically, if we're able to trade off among different things. And here's one of my favorite examples of why understanding exposure is so important. At high levels, lead causes death. Asbestos causes death. These are serious problems. At lower levels, we know that lead has an impact of changing IQ, of having other neurobehavioral issues in children. We can measure IQ. We can measure blood lead. We have a good indicator of what's the relationship between blood lead and CNS lead. And so we can make all sorts of associations and end up, as we have now, with relatively stringent rules, not as stringent as we might all want, but at least relatively stringent rules based upon the ability to put together IQ measurable and blood lead measurable. Maybe asbestos that we've all been exposed to, maybe just a little bit of asbestos causes a little bit of pulmonary fibrosis. And maybe when I walked up four flights of stairs yesterday, I was huffing and puffing more at the top of those four floors than I would have been if I hadn't been exposed to asbestos all these years. I can measure my pulmonary function, do it down to, cc's per minute or something, but I can't measure my asbestos. If I could, we might be regulating asbestos more on these subclinical effects than just on clinical effects. We need to be able to do that. That is something that we need to push more and more, and we just don't do it enough. This is something for Maureen Wickfeld, who is a major push of this, but we have lots of ways to looking at an exposure pathway. We need these for a complete exposure pathway, but I think from a public health point of view, we need to think of this as each one of these steps is a place where we can interdict exposure leading to effects. That's where we can act in a public health way. We need to be able to understand this. We need to understand the various cross-cutting multidisciplinary approaches, and we can go through this. This is just a slide I pulled out on community resilience. Very important community resilience. How do we measure it? How do we put it into metrics which allow us to do good public health policy, to be able to see if our plans, the policy efforts are really successful or not? Again, a real challenge. Cumulative risk assessment. I can't remember how many years EPA has been saying next year we're going to have a cumulative risk assessment approach. It's really hard to do. Some of the exciting things that are coming out that I don't know if Maureen's going to talk about, but you know, of ways to integrate not only across chemicals but across different kinds of lifestyle, social, and behavioral factors are being explored now. Things like telomere shortening and epigenetics. All of these are exciting and something that we need to look at. The anti-scientific attitudes. In this room, I suspect that there are no climate deniers. Okay? So no need to talk about that. But I also would suspect, and certainly in the general audience here at the APHA, that there are folks who believe that GMOs are inherently evil and we should never do any genetic modification for food. We've got a need to meet a perhaps doubling of the amount of calories that are going to be eaten by the year 2050. How do you do that without research? And because we can't meet it now, and how can we just get rid of this potential research tool by just automatically saying there's something wrong with it and we won't do it and it's inherently wrong to do? That's a problem. Precautionary principle advocates who support the ability of purveyors of herbal remedies to avoid demonstrating product safety before sales to the public. I've been fascinated with people who believe that synthetic chemicals are evil, who are opposed to them on a precautionary basis over and over again, but who say, oh, fine, I go to GNC and I get all these herbal remedies all the time, and I don't want FDA to be able to have the same review of these, which are you basically saying that in the case of synthetic chemicals, we want the industry, appropriately, to prove safety, but in case of these herbal things, well, you know, we don't have to have that safety being proved. We'll just assume it's safe. And, of course, the anti-vaccination advocates. So let me get into shale gas, which is where I spend a lot of my time these days. I think you know about shale gas, but just briefly, this is basically a relatively new approach, gradually developed over 60 years or so, in which you stick a pipe underground, you go deep in the shale layer, we talk about a mile underground, bend the pipe laterally, blow holes, and extract the shale by using high-volume hydraulic fracturing under high pressure to get these holes open. The well pads, any of you in the field know that this is, you're looking at an occupational health problem. You're dealing with, in rural areas, you're dealing with in semi-rural areas where it's right across the street from someone's home. And you've got three sources of toxicologically relevant agents. You've got the hydraulic fracturing fluid, which has had most of the emphasis, but you've also got the hydrocarbons and gases and the naturally occurring compounds which come up from below. These have these are far more toxic than the hydraulic fracturing fluids, which have gotten all the attention. And just don't, I mean, I'm a toxicologist, I can say this, it's more toxic. The way to actually prove it, and to prove it in front of a public audience, Katrina Korfak, I saw, is here, we're interested in that. Just basically ask the people to go look online for executives of gas industry folks who are shown drinking their hydraulic fracturing fluid to show how harmless it is. And you can find lots of those. You cannot find any example of them ever drinking the flowback fluid, which is what comes to the surface, not what you're putting deep underground, but comes to the surface and has to be dealt with somehow. the mixture problems, the potential for adverse consequences has been dealt with by industry and by supporters of this by saying, well, it's not a problem. No real issues. Lots of potential issues. There's safety issues, there's air pollution, there's water pollution, the light and noise, the psychosocial effects. There isn't time to go through this, but the community issues with the boom and bust cycles and the housing. You've got a literature that basically shows that there's public health needs when you develop shale gas, but you can't respond protectively in a public health mode if there's no admission that the public health need exists. You've got a bunch of young men coming into a rural area. They're getting lots of money. Despite everybody in the room, that venereal disease rates go up, that there's more drunken driving, that there's more violence. Well, we know how to handle that in public health, but we cannot act proactively to handle those things, to basically prevent them, if there's no admission that there's a problem. And that's part of the issue. Here are three advisory committees that were developed in 2011 and reported in 2012 related to this booming shale gas issue. All three of them have an executive order which says we're interested in information about public health. One's from President Obama, one's from the Democratic governor of Maryland at the time, and the other from a Republican governor of Pennsylvania, a strong shale gas supporter. There are 52 members of these three committees. The amount of people with a public health background, as broadly as you can imagine it, of all those 52 is zero. No one with any public health background was part of these advisors. Now, they're good folks, good engineers, good people from Turtle Lung Limited and Nature Conservancy, but nobody from American Public Health Association, from the American Lung Association, any of those kind of groups. In Pennsylvania, they finally ended up with enough push on our part that we ended up with the advisory committee actually said that there ought to be $2 million a year worth of research being done having to do with classic public health surveillance to see if there's an adverse effect. The $200 million that did get funded from the industry to deal with impacts, not one penny went to public health research. The health department was told to stay out of it. I won't spend the time to go through this, but there's a lot of intentional misleading statements. All three of these are true, but all three are misleading. The one in particular that's most important is the fact that there's the last one, that it's not new in Pennsylvania. It's been going on since the 50s. It's been standard practice since about the 80s. You'll see that kind of statement in the American Petroleum Institute's national television ads, Super Bowl, Final Four. I'm so reassured because I know this is going on for 65 years. That's simply not an appropriate way to look at this. This is so many new things happening that are clearly a risk to the public. So why do I want to make Justice Castile a hero for an approach that looks at the interface between science and policy? Well, there's something in Pennsylvania called Act 13. It really wasn't completely overturned. It was partially overturned. Act 13 was a very pro-Marcellus shale drilling act put in by the Republican governor, with strong support from industry. And the opposition to it, citing the Pennsylvania environmental amendment to our state constitution, was able to get it partially overturned. And part of the reason was that the justice put into their report this thing about the homeowners being ill. Now, those are anecdotes. This is a homeowner and a family. It's an anecdote. It was pointed out to be an anecdote by the industry. The governors immediately went back to the Supreme Court and said, well, no, wait a second. Please reconsider. You should have had an evidentiary hearing to look at the evidence. You can't just use one anecdote as a way of saying that they're violating the environmental constitution of the cause of the constitution of our state. What did Justice Castile say in his decision? It's worth noting that the Commonwealth does not specify whether any independent scientific study has been commissioned, And the absence of data also suggests that the Commonwealth has failed to discharge its trustee duty, a trustee duty, because of this environmental clause in the Constitution, to get the information needed on which to make these decisions. Similarly, New York State soon afterwards said, no, you're not going to do any hydrofracturing in our state. It didn't say never, said basically a very precautionary statement coming out of the fact that Governor Cuomo sent that potential to the Department of Health, and the Department of Health said, well, you know, just isn't enough information to say this is safe. That information could have been obtained. Those studies could have been done. Instead, by not doing them, this industry has hurt itself. It's hurt itself badly. Same thing in Europe. Governments in Europe say, we're going to go drill because we got the Ukraine, we're getting all this gas from Russia. We need to make ourselves free of that. Let's get our own gas. And what's happened time after time again is as they've gone to start off the process, the public has rebelled and has quoted the U.S. figures, has quoted the fact that there is no study that allows you to do this. So let me leave you with a final note, which is what would happen if we did have an environmental amendment to our Constitution? Now, it's not going to happen under this Congress, but it's something that takes a while. Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day, proposed that way back when. Maybe it's time we have that, because maybe that would give us the ability to basically say that there is, as the Justice Castillo did, that there is a duty that the state has to provide the information about potential for adverse health and environmental effects on which decisions are made. Thank you.